We're going to return to the question of Marx's relationship to the utopians and the need for some sort of utopian understanding of a new society is present in the Marxist tradition. The aim of socialism is to create a new foundation for society, which means not only that, you know, the appearance of society would change, but that the foundation would change, that the material basis of society would change, which would require some thinking as to how to change the mode of production. And I don't think that to think along those lines is a violation of the maxim to avoid blueprints for the cook shops of the future.
Marx and Engels both have a habit of actually like praising something in one text and then like shooting it down in the next, and you having to figure out the relationship to why it's okay in this one context and not in the other. And Patton goes through and systematically arranges like the interpretations of what these thrown off phrases mean. But I'll give you some of the phrases that are that people can have good grounds for. We call communism the real movement which abolishes the present state of things. So it's conceived negatively. And Capital, Marx goes furthermore to argue, and this is Capital Volume 1. The construction of the future and its completion for all times is not our task. We do not anticipate the world dogmatically, but whether wish to find a new world through the criticism of the old. And then Marx is often quoted as saying by several people, and it's not in any writing, but it's quoted by George Sorrell, it's referenced by Kalski, any man who draws up a program for the future is a reactionary. Now, what those mean, though, is a different thing. So the common interpretation of that, the most common one, is that the critique is tactical, that these blueprints are essentially a waste of time because of materials reasons, because of the, you know, we went through a chapter of a book, actually, that went through, you know, the essential and non-essential criticisms. I think actually chapter labeled foundational and non-foundational, and the guy argued that they're all non-foundational. Well, this breaks it down in a different way. It's like, well, even if we're not going to worry about whether or not they're essential or non-essential or foundational or non-foundational, we're going to worry about if they're what is the actual critique being made implied in those sentiments.
Could you remind me again of the difference between the foundational and the non-foundational?
Well, foundational means that If it's a foundational criticism, it means there's no possible way you can reconcile anything Marx and Engels is saying to utopian socialism. That they are totally at odds because there is a foundational contradiction or a foundational difference. Non-foundational means there are criticisms and there are essential differences. See, the foundational essential. I would actually say essential for foundational. This is a terminology issue, but there are key differences between the ideas, but they are not essential or fundamentally going to cancel each other out. Like you could hold on to some utopian ideas and still maintain materialism and still maintain historicism and still maintain a kind of openness on how rigid you're going to be on planning, and still maintain that it is not actually that, you know, planning for the future is an anti-democratic.
So as an example, if you were a Christian utopian and you believed that the aim of socialism would be to create a society which was in harmony with itself in terms of all the different classes and castes being in their proper position and operating smoothly, and therefore also in harmony with a divine order,
right?
That would be
foundational,
essentially, or foundationally in opposition to Marx,
right? Because it makes fundamental or foundational the existence of classes, even if they are in harmony and are equal. I admit that really grokking, you know, to use the old Battlestar Galactica term,
it's actually from Stranger in a Strange Land by Heinlein.
Yeah, weirdly, I know that. Stranger in the Strange Land, like the progressive book by a reactionary author.
Yeah, people loved it in the 60s. I don't know why. Well, I do know why, and it's not a pretty story. Anyhow, go ahead.
We will not venture off into the utopian literature of our reactionary
our immediate past. It seems like a never-ending, reproduced.
The never-ending reproduced boomer generation. Yeah. We talked about that if you looked at the epistemological, the democratic argument, and the materialist argument, they are non-foundational. And frankly, according to the chapter of the book we talked about last week, they weren't fair. And I went on to say that not only were they weren't fair, but if you took them seriously as a Marxist, all prior existing formal Marxist not only violates them, but violates them worse than the utopians did.
Mm-hmm. And an example of that would be
God's plan, collectivization, the entire history of actual state socialism, and also most of Western Marxism. That critique is pretty sympathetic to the utopians. So I went through Patton, who is also somewhat sympathetic to to at least pointing out that utopians and Marxism have a much more complicated relationship, and the interpretations by later Marxists of the difference often simplify something.
Well, I think it might come down to that real movement that you talked about of that would abolish the presently existing conditions.
Right.
Because to a concept like the negation of the negation, or to put it in more simple language, the idea that in order to truly get rid of a state of affairs, you have to go beyond saying that what's wrong with it, but have to be able to offer an alternative to it.
Right.
And in material, when you're working with material conditions, that means you need to be able to offer a real living, sensuous relationship and mode of production that could replace the capitalist
right
production.
And also, it's probably not going to emerge at once, even after a revolution. I mean, like, there's no way to... I mean,
negation will emerge at once.
Well, it's an interesting thing to think about, because I on a completely different podcast that I was on where I went through Mike McNair's Revolutionary Strategy book, I pointed out that I accept Mike McNair. Like, there is a certain time when societies change, where even politically certain ideas just are so verboten because of the shift in society. Mm-hmm. That they can't even really, like, you can't politically organize around them. People might still hold them as individuals, mm-hmm. but there is no social force for them. 100 years after the revolutions, trying to bring back hard monarchism, it's not going to happen. And there's no, so, right. like people might believe it, but they're wackadoos and they don't really have any social purchase. If you look at the Brumaire, even immediately after the revolution, weirdly, it's the royalists who uphold the republic. I mean, it gets weird like that, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. To actually be a royalist is impossible. There's that element of this, you know, and we used to talk about this. We used to talk about, like, I think about our early days of popular life, we'd debate about, like, what would world revolution mean? How fast would it have to be to abolish the capitalist state of things? And
I always just said, oh, it would have to be instantaneous or something.
Right.
You
were almost instantaneous, and I'd be like, oh my God. But in a way, it both is and isn't. Like, with these thresholds, there's a point of no return, but you're not gonna know. Like, there's often not a moment you can see when it's happening where that point of no return hits. I mean, even with, like, the Bolshevik Revolution, which is not, like, you know, it wasn't the World Revolution. There's no way anyone who argues that. It's just wrong. I mean, they're not here anymore.
Although they thought that it was. I mean, right. They certainly believed that it was the beginning of it.
But even Lenin knew that Europe had to go in the same direction as the USSR, or they were not going to succeed. I mean, there's no bones about that.
Right.
So... So, okay, so the first interpretation of the Marxist critique of utopian socialist, I find interesting because it's the most common, but it's also the one I think that Patton pretty convincingly argues cannot be true. And we're not, he doesn't classify these as foundational and non-foundational. He's just trying to figure out what is the, to use a term that we use in, you know, when I teach AP kids, what is the exigence? What is the context? What is prompting Marx and Engels to react this way? And what is the nature of their actual reaction? Because, I mean, for all the condemning of utopian socialists, they spend a disproportionate amount of time and borrow a disproportionate amount of ideas from them. Mm-hmm. Like, we always talk about the relationship of Marxism to, say, Adam Smith, you know, mm-hmm. and the imminent emergent critique thing that's going on there. And yes, like, Marx is operating by critiquing the utopian socialists. But when you get imminent critiques that say anything positive at all, Goethe program, the war in France, the Civil War's most pedantry, all those kind of like political texts that are either journalism history or, you know, outright like, you know, treatises that are explicitly political, even if they're kind of imminent critiques. Mm-hmm. The phrases and goals are actually pulled from the utopian literature. And Patton points that out. So what he says here is there's this reading that the utopian tactical orientation, spending any time on the blueprints at all, was a distraction and was, you know, not just a distraction, but counter-revolutionary. And this was a interpretation agreed on by Joseph Schumpeter, who was the Austrian kind of quasi-Marxist socialist, and by Lukes, who believed that utopianism was a political trap because it invested people into ideas that were not, properly speaking, scientific. The utopian speculation is not needed as an organizational tool, as the problems of the capitalists are so severe that the conditions of working class are so bad, they will, of themselves, lead to revolution. So this idea, this is basically the idea that the utopianism is a tactical mistake, is also tied into immiseration theory.
But that presupposes that there can't be such a thing as regression. Right?
Right.
You can't fall into a previous form. Or use some aspects of an economy that will fall into a previous form to prop up a more dominant capitalist relation.
Yeah, and given how much Marx talks about that very thing happening in France, and how much Engels is afraid of it happening in Britain, and even maybe in Germany. That would seem like pretty transparently incorrect interpretation, right? We know, I mean, the Brumaire is about nothing but the party of order not being able to maintain its promise of bourgeois society and actually turning to an older form and getting conned by a, you know, lumpen and petite bourgeois coalition to, you know, to restore the republic by bringing back autocracy. And then it falling apart in a big farce. I mean, we know Marx has a concept of something like regression. And in fact, I mean, depending on how strong a Hegelian you think Marx's theory of like time was, and human action, I mean, regression may be inevitable. Like, now, Marx does not say that. Unless you think immiseration is regression, but the idea that it also basically assumes that capitalism can't itself evolve, which we have to periodize capitalism, even by the time that Marx is talking about, like going from, you know, late mercantile into early capitalism, going into agrarian and merchant capital in England and in the Italian city states, going into, you know, the early industrial capital, which is unquestionably
England. Well, I think the shift from mercantilism to actual industrial capitalism, or just capitalism, is different than the kinds of periodizations that we see after the late 19th century and through the 20th.
There's a fundamental change in the... Yeah,
I would say that the social relationship that sets up production, the proper proletarianization of society, is fully engaged by the 20th century, and that continues throughout the different periodizations, say, as Fordism to neoliberalism.
Whereas if you look at agrarian capital, proletarianization is actually a pretty small part of it. And honestly, also the Ancien regimes and feudal systems are not even totally abolished.
Why those earlier, like, mercantile kind of capitalist relations were truly different as a form of life than what we've seen as a period since then. And I want to hold on to that and say that, because I think that overcoming that capital worker relation should be the aim of socialists today, rather than, I don't know, overcoming the desire to impose upon or dominate nature being the aim of socialism today, or something else.
Continue. The second thing, though, that's in this tactical critique is this: utopian speculation is a necessary diversion from the task at hand, as it takes a great deal of time to publicly work out and justify a detailed ideal society. Finally, utopian speculation tends to be divisive, as every detail in the description of an ideal society can and will be challenged, even within the proletariat itself. Bracket, I added that, but that's clear. Leading to endless and unproductive arguments and divisions.
Okay, I do believe that if you want to just sit back and write down a fully worked out plan for how all the relations would occur in our future socialist society, that you will be wasting your time, because what you'll end up with is we published a book actually that was similar, that was a kind of utopian book about a society based on mostly on bicycle travel and a certain way of farming, and it was like it had a map of a little village and all that mapped out the ways that people would relate and the way things would be distributed. And it was very much in the old style of the utopians, the ones that Marx criticized. And that didn't particularly sell well, although it was a beautiful little edition, really. And it would never have any kind of purchase amongst anyone except lifestylists in the Pacific Northwest, or who knows where, maybe Hawaii, or I don't know. I think that planning as a part of your revolutionary activity, when you give the workers the sense that they're responsible for creating a new set of relations, and therefore they have to work with people who can maybe do, from other working class positions or not, who can maybe give you more technical information than you might have about the ins and outs of the process, they could start to implement or conceive of implementing that new form of relations. Like, just as an example that may not fit, during strikes, mass strikes, there usually were efforts to keep production going and to communicate amongst workers to maintain both the flow of goods and transportation. And the networks of communication that were formed in those kinds of moments might be at least the prototypes for a sustainable future set of relations.
When you think about emergent social organization, and I'm going to use social technology here because I don't really have a good other word for it, but social technology is like the interface between material and social organizational things, you can get pretty interesting emergent things that have massive transformationary powers. I mean, the biggest example that everyone focuses in on that I think is actually super important, because it gives us the internet and a whole lot of other stuff, is the way Soviet planning tried to deal with the issues it had with Gazprom, started coming up with the ideas that led to cybernetic theory, but also politically freaked out and suppressed it. And then tried to readopt it after it had pretty much given it over to the capitalist world. And the capitalists have made kind of a mutual non-aggression pact in America to develop this through the military, and then the military give the R&D back to them. Although many of the initial, many of the initial physical technologies in, you know, touch screens, all the, you know, certain kinds of screen, not touch screens, but certain kinds of LED screens, stuff like that, those actually were even developed in the Soviet Union before they were developed by, you know, proper capitalist tech. The issue, though, and it's an issue that, you know, when you and I have our debates on what exactly was the Soviet Union, that I'll grant you, is that a lot of this stuff ends up just mirroring capitalist production anyway, because they're also trying to compete on the same playing field. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have similar problems with emergent worker technologies trying to reproduce the exact same society we have now during, say, a strike, without also having, and this is where I'm granting some of your points about utopianism, some sort of reorienting teleological, you know, some sort of like grand unifying mode, not even mode of production. And
Can I put forward a thought about Marx that might help? Mm-hmm. Marx thought that today the problem with our mode of production was multiple, but one of the things about it that was the big problem was that it was alienating. Mm-hmm. That we saw our relationships as being taking place in the market when in fact they were really taking place at the level of production. So a society in which that would not be alienating, when we would not be alienated from our mode of production, would be one in which the aim of life was production rather than consumption. We wouldn't be in service of the commodities we produce, but rather the commodities we produce would be in service to our own expression through production.
Right.
Maybe I've said this before.
So you would have de-alienated labor in the sense that if you did labor, it's because you wanted to do it. Are you just actually needed the thing?
Well, both.
Right.
Those things can't be separated. Needing the thing would be part of wanting to do another thing.
Right. And interesting, people who are artisans and have a closer relationship to their production. So even though it's highly inefficient and kind of backwards, frankly, mm-hmm. have less alienated labor. And you're like, that's why like every now and then some liberal will be like, you just become a carpenter, because it's kind of a necessarily inefficient, very specific kind of work that you often pretty much do yourself. You're an artisan, you're a petite bourgeois tradesperson, like you might have one employee who, you know, may even be in your family. Like, those kinds of businesses are less alienated.
Imagine a different form of alienation to support the vision I have here. So I mean, yeah, there's the idea that, okay, if you want to do a certain kind of thing, then you have to do something else first yourself in order to do it. So if you want to be a carpenter, you're going to have to manufacture or find a way to get a hold of the tools you need for carpentry. And you're probably going to have to make some of them yourself. Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff you're going to have to do, but. Yeah,
right. So, but the other way to think of it is, okay, we have a massive machinery already developed by capitalism for production. And what we need to do is get it set up so that we can find out what the most popular ways of producing are, well, the kinds of things that people want to spend their time doing. Mm-hmm. And then through incentivizing it and maybe gamification or advertising or who knows what else, create another realm of production which people would also participate in that would support the more popular forms of production. So
just like cybernetics, I hate the fact that we give gamification to weirdo liberal Silicon Valley nut jobs. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, we could, there, you change the relationship of labor, and you also change like the mediating factor, because one of the things people I got in our argument with some of the structural monetary theorists have theories now that I'm having trouble even conceptualizing, like, you know, they're telling me that they think credit precedes not just money, but debt and also maybe accumulation. And I'm just like, off of what? Like, what anthropological source could you possibly have for that assertion? Because the level of extraction you're talking, that's like the highest level of extraction that usually involves a high amount of state infrastructure coming first. My thing that you're saying here that I kind of think that we're going to get to a patent too is like, you do need these kind of reorientations. You can't just, and people really don't understand why I really harp on this, but I'm like, you can't just like democratize capitalist technology that does capitalist things and fully expect, without massive social reorganization and probably some real re-technological design that we could do. I mean, you're not starting from scratch, but like,
we can democratize it, but then we have to understand that the goal of the democratic decision making is to transform the mode of production. If you simply democratize your workplaces to try to make them better versions of what already is, to make decisions that are already pre-formulated,
that's
by
literally
the
capitalism with a human face.
Yeah,
that's literally what it is. Like, and it's only good if, like, one of the things I pointed out about like this kind of cynicalist view of like everyone's in a co-op. I'm like, but those co-ops still have to compete against each other to generate profits for their co-op members. Otherwise, they can't function. And in places like Mondragon, that leads to like, yes, it leads to less alienated workforces if you are in the co-ops, but they don't always function that way, and they're not competitive, you know, with the world market, except when they cut on the margins to maintain that. And people who've studied it closely, who aren't, you know, trying to sell you something, are like it's better than a privately owned or a publicly traded, actually, which is even worse, corporate firm, but it's still doing some of the exact same things. Anyway, to get back, so you have to have a reorganizational principle. And one of the things that Patton points out here, okay, and I'll get into this. He actually, one of the people who, Schopenhauer and Lukes, who actually believe the tactical thing, uses to criticize Marxism. And I don't know about Sorel, because maybe Sorel did too, because Sorel gets weird. George Sorel, the guy who, the first revisionist to Marxism, who, you know, came up with the myth of violence through the impossible general strike. Like, like, what is useful about the general strike is not that you could actually do it, but that is the myth to organize a working class. Mm. He's considered one of the transitionary figures between Marxism and also syndicalist Marxism in France and Spain, and proto-fascism and fascism. I mean, you know, Sorel was a Mussolini fan. So
what did he say about the utopians here? Go back to,
well,
that.
I mean, Lukes and this I'm reading about Lukes and Schopenhauer, who both end up not really being Marxists, even though they kind of start there. Luke says that this tactical consideration actually contributed to the abstract nature of Marxist theory, because they were afraid of actually stating anything explicit, and they wanted to avoid programs. Now, as a side note, as I mentioned historically, yes, there were actually all Marxists attempted programs, which also is hard to reconcile with that whole anyone who writes a program for the future. They got around this by transitional, you know, which is Second International.
By having the right reformist demands within capitalism, you're not actually trying to change the system. You're trying to move towards a revolutionary rupture by challenging the system at its weak points.
Exactly. So you create space and accelerate the contradictions, as they say, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the minimum program tactic. And then the transitional program tactic tries to do the same thing that the minimum program tactic, but in a kind of, we're not just going to do the minimal needs to create space. We're going to try to do some prefiguration. Because we also think that the imminent collapse of capital is coming. So Luke says this led to Marxism failed to clarify its ends and to explore its institutional and political forms that could embody them. And as a result, totally failed to bring about political and social imagination on existing problems and thus often gets led by capital. Luke's is actually trying to explain when we talked about Hilferding and how, you know, the monopoly capital problems and all that, that's part of what's going on there. And then the other thing that Luke's implies is that it leads to us talking in abstractions because we're afraid if we're too specific, even on critiques, that we will be laying down blueprints for the future, and that's a tactical waste of time. Now, what Patton says is this just can't be Marx's concern, even though they said this. And I'll read exactly what Patton says. Although Marx and Engels did think utopian speculation can harm a revolutionary movement, this seems to be partly because of poor interpretations of their. This seems to be a poor interpretation of their criticism of utopian socialists. Although some passages can be found to support it, the fact that they went to great lengths to criticize the details of the utopian socialist theories makes it unlikely that they thought that this simple criticism was their main point, as it would be no reason to criticize details if the project as a whole was flawed from the beginning. Moreover, the fact that they developed their own vision of an ideal society, and I'm going to put in brackets, even negatively, by itself is enough to warrant the rejection of this interpretation. Given that their views on the political failings of the utopian socialists, Marx and Engels were understandably worried about the negative effects of utopian speculation, but they did not reject utopianism purely on tactical grounds. So we can just say, right, they couldn't have, or they wouldn't have spent so much time on it. That would have been irrational. Like, you could have just said, take go get rid of that air in the airy fairy crap. The other thing that he puts on in the second critique, and the second critique is a strategic critique, which is the one which while less common was believed by more important people. So the people who he attributes this critique to was Kalski, Lukash, Miner, and Jamieson. So I mean, like, now we got names we know, as far as Marxists go.
Wow, and Frederick Jamieson, he talks about in the same breath as Kautsky. Go ahead.
Well, you will notice we start off with actual political leaders going through Lukács or people who are theorists and in the pure theorist, as in the late Graeber used to criticize Marxism as a whole for doing.
But Frederick Jamieson and Graeber have more in common than Kautsky and Graeber do. So, I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to speak ill of the dead.
I don't know that that's ill even, but yeah. So here's what they thought. Kalski argued from within the Marxist tradition, and this, I'm going to use Kalski, this is usually where you have St. Kalski, right? Argued that from within the Marxist tradition that utopian socialism was utopian less on the account of the impracticability of its aims than on the account of the inadequacy of its means at its disposal for its achievement. So their strategic critique is different from the tactical one. And so the strategic critique is not that what they're wanting to do is necessarily bad in and of itself, even though Marx might complain about it. It's that how they think they can do it is stupid.
Yeah, well, often that's just plainly true, right? I mean, the utopians were allergic to violent political movements. They thought that they could do it in their own factories. The utopians have maybe something in common with the communizers in that regard.
Right.
I've been reading Gil Dove, and his idea, the problem with communization is not the value theory stuff. The value theory stuff that they have is pretty good. The problem is not their critiques of the existing left. Their problem is that they want to say, oh, well, what we need to do. I mean, they're not different than anarchists. We need to, on the local level, on a neighborhood by neighborhood level, create alternative structures.
Prefigurative societies to fight the real succession as capitalism either A, collapses, or we deal with it B, locally, depending on the kind of communization. And we can't use strikes to do it because the work site's no longer the place of struggle, because the working class can't get over itself and accept its own abolition. So we need riots.
Yeah, I mean, Dove doesn't say that.
No, but that's implied if you add Dove to, say, Clover or... certain interpretations of certain in notes articles. I mean, like, to be fair, I'm reading modern, more recent in notes, and they're not like
Clover that. Riot, strike, riot.
Was that? I believe it was Clover. It was one of the two poets. It was either Clover or Barnes, but I believe it was Clover.
Let me just
riot, up. Strike, riot.
Yeah, Joshua Clover.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this moment right now, anyway, we can talk about that in what I'll not call the parrot room, but in the private pop, about what we call
it. Yeah, we're in private pop, the private pop and Patreon pop, where we actually talk crap about modern stuff.
Yeah,
to sell this. If we talk about modern stuff, it's in the Patreon. I think Kowski's actually kind of unquestionably right. It's hard to think that was the only thing Marx and Engels were getting at, though, because, like, again, if that's the only problem.
They were also getting to the detailed problems of their actual visions of utopian.
Right.
Right. I mean, look, here's the thing. On the one hand, I remember back when I was a peace activist, there was an allergy to being political at all. All people wanted to deal with was slogans, because and the reason they wanted to deal only in slogans was because there was too much ideological disagreement in this left group about what was needed to actually overcome
the
tendency towards war.
So sloganeering is a way to paper over it, because you're using up. It's actually really, it is like the first step in formal reification. Hide it under an abstract, like
we're for peace and not for war. That's it. Don't say more.
Right. What do we mean by either and why and how?
Right, yeah. Right. All that. So, and I would say that the same impulse is there when it comes to not wanting to talk about our vision for the future. There is so much time that needs to be spent getting it wrong. And there's a feeling of pressure to get it right immediately. And not only to get it right immediately because we're facing immense problems, but also on a personal level, you want to be the best Marxist. You don't want to be the guy who got it wrong, right? I mean, on the internet, that's certainly how things operate. If you're forming an organization, you're going to be forming an organization perhaps around one of these utopian ideas. And to get it wrong means you have to disband and join some other group, or, you know, admit that your project was flawed. And when you're dealing with sectarian groups, that can never happen. So, I mean, there's lots of things that would impede the open kind of conversation that would be necessary, and the kind of leap of faith that would be necessary to invest in thoroughly and ruthlessly critiquing different projects or plans for changing the mode of production.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the things that you have to look at in this is that Kowski's basically right, but he's also, like, the strategic issue, the backup for that argument, as is pointed out, it's not just that, like, Marx and Engels, they took a lot of stuff directly from these thinkers. They point out that so much of this stuff comes from these guys, and that Engels in particular, but Engels and Marx both, would acknowledge it, particularly with the early, like... just like they acknowledge a lot of good stuff in Adam Smith, like they acknowledge the stuff they liked in the thinker. So it's not the strategic critique has grounds there. The issue that they had is some of the utopian socialists don't really talk about class abolition, even though they're talking about the end of property. They kind of thought you could abolish property and the classes would just kind of get along. The other thing is almost all of them are pacifist. They think you can prefigure this by just developing these communities and people will come to them because obviously they're awesome. That we have to be insistent that the goal is class abolition more than any other element of what we're doing. Because if we, you know,
I look forward to, the third episode on utopianism. I think that'll be really good. I also want to say that, people who, are not Patreon supporters may want to become Patreon supporters if you've watched this far, because, what we're going to do in the next hour after I get refill my wine glass a little bit is, trash Angela Nagel. And to whet the appetite for that conversation, I just want to say this to you. This whole conversation, I think, might be used by Nagel and her friend. Who was her friend that was with her on that?
Malcolm Kenyatta. I don't know. It's a Swedish name. It's K-Y-E-Y-E.
The Swedish reactionary would probably point to our conversation in the last hour and say it's precisely the kind of pseudo-socialist, jargon-ridden, empty talk that we hide behind when what we're really all about is, I don't know what,
serving the interest of the neoliberal elite, even though,
or someone.
So, I mean, but yeah, let's talk about that, because the other
we'll have to respond to these people now. I mean, and one thing anyway, we'll talk about it in the private,
Private Patreon, if you want to hear us talk about, because I'm sure this one's, and I will say this, guys, we're actually going to try not to be super ad hominem-y on this, because that actually feeds the problem.
It does. And also, I still think that ultimately Kill All Normies is a book that was deserving of being published, and that Angela Nagel herself had opportunities and other directions she could have gone without fundamentally changing her core beliefs around things like the family and so forth and so on. But so I'm going to end it there. We'll talk about all this later. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books book club and help us to continue making online content from the left.